And, you know, Nikola Tesla had these things 100 years ago.
The individualization of power. In other words, can I take a little box and just run my house out?
So we got all this stuff, we can do this, and we've shown this, but nobody's helping us, and we can't get the government to pop over, you know.
That's why they're taking to the streets. This is where the revolution's going to happen.
What do you think would happen if we put $1 billion into free energy?
This is Global BEM Transmissions, the broadcast of the global breakthrough energy movement, presenting voices and ideas from around the planet to activate awareness, promote understanding, and advance the deployment of breakthrough energy technologies. Technologies that not only solve our planet's critical problems, but work to create a unified experience of abundance, creativity, and peace. And now we welcome you to this edition of Transmissions. And welcome once again to Global BEM Transmissions. I'm Randy Moggins. I am your host for this edition of Transmissions. And before we begin today, the big event, October 10th, 11th, and 12th, at the University of Colorado Boulder, the Global BEM Conference, featuring speakers such as Dan Winner, Sterling Allen, Catherine Austin Fitz, Michael Tellinger, and our guest for this segment of Transmissions. Foster Gamble is a direct descendant of the Gamble family, the soap makers and founders of the U.S. consumer goods company Procter & Gamble. He grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and spent his childhood in a rather privileged environment and attended elite private schools and a collegiate career at Princeton University. He was groomed to be a leader in the establishment, but as a young boy, Gamble had an inquisitive personality that led him to envision a world scenario of universal energy source. A lifelong journey in the pursuit of knowledge, he involved himself in many intellectual subjects. His discontent with the current structure of power in the world, massive global suffering, Foster Gamble and his wife Kimberly set out to make a documentary that unveiled the true reality of our existence in the 21st century. That film, Thrive, released on 11/11/2011, closely paralleled the Occupy movement and the rising drumbeats of the 2012 shift. A call for change around the planet with increasing focus on free energy, ending the Federal Reserve global banking cabal, the industrial food system, our rigged political system, and realigning humanity to the natural rhythms of our cosmos. We welcome to Transmissions, Foster Gamble. Foster, it's good to talk to you today.
Thank you, Randy. Good to be with you.
And I must say, I just viewed the Thrive film again. I hadn't seen it since its original release, but I saw it a few days ago. And the production values on that film, Foster, have really stood up. It's an excellent effort. I understand that you and Kimberly did most of the production work yourself.
Well, she was the producer and director. We co-wrote it. And I was in charge of the visual design of it. So it was a fabulous co-creative opportunity to work with her. And then we had a wonderful team of photographers, sound people, special effects people, and you know, script consultants. And it took a team for sure. And we worked on it for about 8 years on the film and the website in order to release that level of quality.
Oh, wow. 8 years. That's really a long-term project.
Well, it was really a life's work and a labor of love for me, because the research has really been my entire lifetime. And I was a filmmaker in college, but when I graduated, I realized I didn't have anything to say that was important enough to do what all it takes to create a major feature film. So I dedicated my life instead to trying to figure out why we were destroying planet Earth and at war with with other human beings and all of that. And I told my friends, if I find a coherent understanding of that and solutions, a way out that is commensurate to the problem, then I'll make the film. And I thought it might take 10 years. It took over 40, but I'm happy to say that's what all led to Thrive.
Watching that movie and hearing you describe your early childhood experiences, especially as you begin to perceive the energy patterns around you, We're of a very similar age, and I can't help but think that in a lot of ways there was a destiny for our generation growing up, that there was actually what I call a crack in the cosmic egg, where we as a generation began to break through. Do you feel like you had a destiny to do this, a commitment, a calling in some way? And was your position in life in some way provided to, I guess, enable people like you to begin breaking through the barriers?
Well, I really do. And it's been a great privilege to be able to have some extra money so that I could actually keep pulling on the threads of what's really going on that's in the way of our thriving, and then keep going through that understanding to what we can actually do about it. And I mention in the film, and we illustrate the a real turning point for me was when I was in, I think it was sixth grade, and did my first air raid drill of ducking under the cover, I mean under the desk and covering my head in order to protect me from the explosion of a nuclear bomb. And that's really a moment when I thought, okay, the adults in charge don't necessarily know what they're doing. I'm going to have to do a lot of this on my own. And frankly, I spent a lot of my childhood and adolescence in real terror about the nuclear situation. And I think that that's one of the things that kept me on track to try to figure out what was going on with energy. And then when I had that other vision that you just mentioned, that's also illustrated in Thrive, when I was riding on a school bus at age 14, and I was just kind of gazing out the window, and the sunlight was flickering through the trees, probably helped put me in a trance. And all of a sudden, I saw this whirlpool vortex really clearly, and it took form as an atom, with the nucleus at the center and the planets going around the outside. And then I watched it transform into a solar system, you know, with the sun at the center and the planets going around the outside. As I watched, I had this whole kinesthetic experience. This energy just came over me. And I knew that somehow I was that same pattern, and that I was roughly halfway between in scale between the tiny atom with its electrons and the solar system with its planets. And when I came out of that vision, my physics teacher at the time was sitting in the front of the bus. And so I ran up to him and told him what I had just experienced. And to his credit, he said, rather than saying, well, duh, he said, what an amazing idea. Keep going with that and let me know what you come up with. And the fact of the matter was, I did keep going with that for the entire rest of my life. And that's what led me a lot to into the physics, into the geometry and cosmology, and ultimately into the field of free energy itself.
I always found it ironic. I remember those drills too, and I remember being herded down into a basement bomb shelter. I remember people around me, you know, people who had the means to do so, building underground bomb shelters, and this overarching fear of the nuclear holocaust that was part of this whole Cold War environment that people grew up in the 60s and the 70s with, the fear meme that kind of permeated this new thing that they called atomic power, nuclear power, and how we navigated around that fear to get to a place where we now are able to embrace energy from a much wider perspective and realize that everything that's destructive is also creative, and it's simply a matter of intention. Is that part of your understanding, Foster, as you grew into this knowledge as well?
Yeah, I think that the energy forms themselves are really the key, and then how we relate to them determines our destiny. You know, when I saw that pattern of what the mathematicians call the torus, this donut-shaped whirlpool vortex, what I learned when I began studying it, which I did obsessively for decades after that, is that that torus pattern isn't, in fact, the only pattern that sustains a healthy system in the universe. It's a requirement for energy to feed in one side and go out the other side, and to rotate around the stillness at the center, and to maintain its balance, its integrity, a balance of energy in with energy out, and so forth. And that torus pattern, it turns out, can be a template for humanity to design our own systems in a sustainable way. I mean, if it's the only thing that the universe uses to sustain healthy systems, then wouldn't it be a good idea, when we're at the risk of destroying ourselves and life as we know it on planet Earth, to take the universe's hint, which is really there at every single level, from subatomic particles to the clustering of galaxies. If we know how to look, we will see that pattern at every single level. But if we can kind of unpack the principles of that pattern, then we can use it to shape our banking systems and our communication systems and our media systems, and especially our energy systems. Because as I mentioned in the movie, in my experience of being invited into new energy labs around the world, every single one that I've been into that is in fact being successful at tapping this boundless field of energy is in some way honoring or mimicking the Taurus pattern. And so the real paradigm shift here is, instead of exploding things like they were doing in such a dangerous way with nuclear power, or even internal combustion, having to smash things, burn things, and so forth in order to take the energy out. You know, that's a very old macho way of doing it that has taken us
very much so, yes.
It's taken us to the brink of our own destruction. So we need to learn from the feminine energy at this point and stand back and go, okay, what's the dance that's going on here? The universe is doing these exquisite vortices of infinite energy. And if we're humble enough to recognize that and then dance with that, then we can access that boundless energy. You know, Tesla is known for saying that before many generations pass, we shall attach our devices to the wheel works of nature. He knew very well about these toroidal vortices. I think that's what he was referring to as the wheel works. You know, that in every atom, you know, all the protons, all the electrons, they're all these toroidal vortices just arranged in natural, most efficient 3D geometries. So I think our challenge now is to learn humbly to dance with this boundless force of nature rather than to try to, you know, dominate it.
You know, it's interesting that toroidal image, the wheel, so to speak, is so prevalent in ancient history as well. I mean, we clearly, if we look back, I mean, it's in ancient manuscripts, it's on ancient sites, as you demonstrate as well inside the film. It's illustrated in the Book of Ezekiel, in the scriptures. There is this enduring image of something that humanity has not gotten a hold of. This, it's like we decided to go in another path and break away from the natural forms of energy and go towards what I call the vertical pyramidal hierarchy, as you also illustrate in Thrive. Was that a deliberate, in your opinion, attempt to hijack humanity, or was it simply us fumbling through our own ignorance?
Well, I think it was some of each. I think it's our own ignorance that's kept us from blocking an intentional plan by the would-be controllers to distort esoteric knowledge, to literally flip cosmic geometry, sacred geometry, on its end, and to fool us into thinking that we are limited beings who need to be controlled by others. And, you know, what the source was of the kind of sickness that would have them doing that, you know, would be a whole nother show in itself. But just suffice it to say that my research reveals very consistently that there's fortunately a small number of people, but they're in tremendous positions of power because they figured out this banking scheme 400 years ago and have been in the process of using their right to print money when the rest of us can't, to, you know, to take over the world. But as you say, and I'm really glad you brought up this whole thing about ancient cultures, because this Taurus notion, when I realized how profound it was, I realized, you know, who else knew about this? Because I knew it wasn't my good idea. I was just recognizing something in nature. And as I began to look, as you say, you know, it's throughout the art, all, you know, back through the Renaissance, back into Egypt, and many, many cultures around the world, you'll see these same drawings of both the spirals and toroidal vortices but also of the structural geometry. It's what Bucky Fuller called the vector equilibrium, which is kind of the mother of all geometries, which literally is the portal to the void, you know, to literally, I mean, more accurately, the plenum of infinite energy. So when you look at legends like the Ark of the Covenant, you know, do we really think that it was just a box with a bunch of clay tablets with orders on it, when it was in fact, you know, made of gold in perfect five proportions, you know, gold on the inside and then acacia wood, gold on the outside with these large electrodes in solid gold on the top that literally had an arc between the electrodes. And people were warned, you know, not to touch it, not to approach it without, you know, certain protective gear. And so given that that Ark of the Covenant was became the primary artifact of Judaism, Islam, and Christianity.
Yes.
Do we really think that just a big old ornate box did that? Or was that in fact a capacitor? Because it was built exactly like a capacitor and had qualities that seemed to indicate that it was in fact an energy device. And you know, you look at the legends of the burning bush, which was connected with that also. Was that really just a bush that caught fire, or was there some sort of, you know, vehicle of light that had conscious beings that passed on some really critical knowledge that then got built into the Ark of the Covenant?
Yeah, there are all of these very strange legends and mythologies that run through all of our cultures, actually, even as far back as the ancient Far East, that indicate that humanity, ancient man, knew something that we have forgotten or lost along the way. You began financing many years ago a symposium, I think the Sequoia Symposium, is that correct?
Yes.
Where you began to, I guess, open up an inquiry into these matters. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how that led you into the next level of your research?
Yeah, it was a really exciting time because my own research had kind of come to fruition. My search for this fundamental pattern for decades had come down to that the fundamental pattern is the torus. That's the flow pattern and the vector equilibrium, the structure. And there were several other people that I was in touch with. Lynn Claire Dennis, a near-death survivor who had seen these patterns in great detail when she was beyond her body. And then Jim Fournier and mathematician Luke Kaufman and several others. And we decided the time had come to have an interdisciplinary think tank to check out this notion that these were, in fact, the fundamental patterns of the universe. So the first conference had 35 scientists from all over the world, and they were traditional scientists, you know, from Stanford and MIT and Caltech and so forth, you know, Georgia Tech, in the areas of physics and astronomy, astrophysics, chemistry, biology, and so forth, but also near-death survivors and mystics and psychologists, you know, people who were studying all different levels, because, you know, we're trained in our academic system to divide the world up into these categories, and then you know, they call them a course, and you pay to take this course, and you regurgitate the information and so forth. Mm-hmm. Hardly anyone stops to tell you, you know, the universe is this one seamless continuum, and we've just found it useful to start at the smallest and call that physics. And then when it starts getting a little larger, we call it chemistry. And when it forms into these certain forms, we call it biology. And then when it takes on certain levels of consciousness, you know, we call it psychology. And then that's embedded in astrophysics and so forth. So we really wanted to have all the different levels represented. And then to explore from each perspective, are these the fundamental patterns, or are there other ones that we should be considering? So there were string theorists who could come in with the mathematics, and it turned out that as close as they had come to the geometry of the unified field was what they called the E8 group, which turns out to be found, you know, the foundation of that is the vector equilibrium. Every single scientist at every level agreed that the torus was in fact fundamental to their area of observation. So that conversation, I mean, it sounds easy, but it actually took 3.5 years of several conferences a year to finally get to that sort of alignment. And there were some traditional scientists who you know, were not ready to go there yet, and some of these ideas threatened their worldview, and they dropped out, and others came in. But finally, there was this conference at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And at the end of that conference, we had really come to such alignment about these two fundamental patterns that there was just quiet in the room. And we had a final breakfast and where we kind of looked around and said, okay, you know, we accomplished what we set out to do, but now so what? What is this? What are the implications of this? And then things got really exciting for the next phase. And we all basically created independent groups that stayed in touch with each other. And some people went off to write physics papers. People like Nassim Haramein has written. I put him together with a physicist, Elizabeth Rauscher, and they've done 5 just absolute breakthrough papers and based on this same sort of realizations. And another team went off to build energy devices. And another team I headed up called the Atomic Geometry Team. And we took basically these same notions to dive down into the periodic table of elements with the postulates that we had come to believe were true and see if we could do computer modeling of all 92 elements as 3D geometric forms that would follow certain mathematical principles that we had come to and see if then the phenomenon would match up with the data from quantum physics about the, you know, number of electrons and protons in each shell of each atom as you go from the simplest hydrogen, you know, to the most complex with uranium. So those projects have also been coming to very exciting fruition, and a lot of it has led toward, you know, one of the reasons I'm talking with you today is I'm really excited about this whole free energy movement and this breakthrough energy movement conference that they're having the second one of in Boulder, as you mentioned, in October. We're going to be exploring all of these different issues, and it's really emerging all over the world now, and it's going to take a lot more than just, you know, a couple of good devices to give humanity access to clean, cheap, abundant energy. Mm-hmm. It's going to take those devices, and those devices, I'm happy to report, are already in existence. But in addition to that, you know, it's going to take media, it's going to take networking, it's going to take vetting, it's going to take funding and business models, it's going to take security strategies, it's going to take legal strategies, as well as, you know, distribution and PR and marketing. All of that has to be done successfully to really give humanity access to this. So at that conference, we'll not only be studying the history of the development of technologies and its suppression, but also what's going on in these various interrelated realms, because the business people are now talking to the science people, or, you know, talking, the theorists are talking to the inventors, and the money people are starting to come in, and the people who are really good at media and sales, you know, are starting to come in. So the time has finally come for this collaboration to come to fruition. You know, they had electric cars in the 70s, but we didn't get to drive them because they got suppressed.
Right.
Now there are electric cars on the road. Nikola Tesla had free energy, you know, working 100 years ago. Now the time is coming when people are going to begin to get access to it all. But it's a daunting challenge.
In the 2 years since the release of Thrive, well, it's been almost 2 years since the release of Thrive, I'm wondering if you're optimistic that this manifesto that you and Kimberly sounded back then is reaching its intended audience. Are we making a dent now? We have the internet. We have alternative media. I've been working at this for over 5 years now, and sometimes I've been discouraged, and sometimes I've been wildly optimistic. Since the release of Thrive, how optimistic are you that we're making a major penetration into the consciousness of humanity with this message?
Well, I love that question, and I'm glad you're asking it now, because there have been times in the past when I was you know, pretty gloomy about the whole situation.
Yeah.
I am very, very hopeful now, and especially because Kimberly and I have had the chance to travel to more than 30 cities around the world and just see who's there. You know, we all get so misled by mainstream media. But when you actually go out to these cities, and we've had a chance to be with just in packed auditoriums with so many people who get it, they're waking up, and they're motivated to get on with solutions. In fact, so many people were spontaneously creating Thrive-inspired solutions groups to take on various issues that we created a new aspect of our website called the Solutions Hub so that they could have a place to meet and share best practices, you know, to share petitions and lawsuits and resources and you know, just lessons hard won and so forth. And so that's been up maybe 7 or 8 months now, and there's over 830 groups from 90 countries around the world who are already participating in that. And Thrive, you know, we never did any major marketing campaign for Thrive, and it's being seen now by well over 1 million people a month. The number of documented views is over 18 million, but that's counting one view per DVD, and people right. are using it for, you know, home screenings. They're using it for community screenings with hundreds of people coming. And so it's probably more like somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 20, 30, 40 million. Now, compared to, you know, a population of 7 billion on the planet, that's hardly a dent. But the people who are ready for this information are beginning to get access to it, and they're integrating it and taking action. And I know that my research showed me that the American Revolution was only fought by about 5% of the
That's
population.
Correct. Yes.
Ken Wilber says it only takes 10% to change the whole paradigm of a human community. And the research of a guy named Paul Ray, who wrote the book literally on cultural creatives, his update on that recently shows that the percentage of so-called cultural creatives, which he defines as people who shape their lives around the values of environment, health, and social justice, is now running between 30 and 35% in Europe, Japan, and America. So the numbers of people that people like you are reaching with alternative ways of thinking and deeper information that is true and really important, I'm very, very encouraged by the way that people are waking up and what they're doing with it.
In your travels, are you seeing a cross-section of people, age demographics and things like that? I had two young men visit my house yesterday, friends of my son's, 19 years old, 20 to 28 years old, couple of young people, and it got brought up in the conversation that I was interviewing you today, and they were very excited. They had all seen the video, and they were actually here to talk to me about some alternative business solutions that they've been coming up with. Tell me a little bit about what excites you and what you're seeing, especially with young people, but you know, age isn't the factor here. I think this really is hitting a cross section.
Oh, yeah, Randy, it's absolutely a cross-cultural, cross-gender, cross-class, cross-age. I was on a Skype with a Thrive group in Houston a couple of weeks ago, and somebody, you know, came up to the computer to interact with me. He had just turned 80, and he was a lifelong banker with Bank of America. Mm-hmm. And he had just seen Thrive a few days before, and he said, in my entire career, I never knew. So he said now he's passing out Thrive to all of his old banker friends. and then a few weeks before that, I was interviewed by a 12-year-old girl from the East Coast who has her own online radio program.
Yeah, that's
awesome.
And she's
incredibly well-versed in so many of these issues. So much so that I finally said to you, you know, are you getting hassled at all? You know, have the intelligence agencies been bugging you at all? And she said, yeah, I've been approached twice by the CIA. First, they wanted to hire me. Then when I said no, they wanted to buy my show. When I said no, then they threatened me. And she said, no, I'm not stopping doing this show. So that's a quick example. And, you know, we've been, there's a big following in Mexico. Kimberly and I are going down to an economic summit down there that's including the president of Mexico, and the guy who's running the summit says he's the number one fan of Thrive in Mexico. We've had, as you could understand, a lot of enthusiasm from places like Iran and Iraq and Greece and Iceland, where their cultures are just being devastated. Their economies are collapsing, and they didn't know why. And for a lot of them, the film has just gone viral in university communities in foreign countries, especially because people are finally, through the film, getting a coherent story of the collapse that's going on. So even though it's scary to get the information, it's more scary to just see the collapse and be confused and feel helpless about it.
Well, you mentioned the 80-something banker, and undoubtedly this gentleman went through his life in the compartmentalization that all of us grew up with to some level.
Yes.
And there's this tendency to make scapegoats and enemies of people who are, quote, inside the system. But in my conversations with people over the years, I've discovered that they too were cogs in the wheel and basically had experienced a kind of a horrible awakening, especially after the debacle in 2008 when they basically imploded our economy. Are you seeing people who are struggling with this consciousness waking up, people who have lived in the system for a long time?
Absolutely, because it's a huge leap, particularly, you're in your 50s or 60s and you've built a career and, you've got a mortgage on your house and you're feeding your kids. Maybe you've got grandkids and you've got a reputation and so forth. All of a sudden to wake up to these realities and to even start talking about them, much less do a career path jump, is a very challenging and courageous act. I was working with a Thrive group in Denver a while ago, and this man came up to me and he said, I used to work for Bank of America, and I saw Thrive a couple of months ago, and he said, and the next day I submitted my resignation. A week later I was gone, and he said, I've only been out a couple of months now, but he said, I've never been happier in my life, because the truth of the matter was, he always wanted to be a spiritual teacher, and he devoted all his hobby time to that, but he just made the leap and was actually already having success with that and not kind of cringing about what he was doing with most of his days. And I'm just seeing more and more, artists, business people, media people, journalists and so forth, just making that leap from the traditional but limited paths into something which really matches their soul. And I just really congratulate them, because that could have so easily been me, because I was a real, high achiever in school and college and, expected to be a filmmaker or a politician or something like that. And if I hadn't been woken up to what was really going on, I could have found myself, like a lot of other people that I knew from back then, climbing to the top of a ladder and finally getting there and turning around and realizing that the ladder was against the wrong wall.
Yeah, it is a horrible awakening, and there are a lot of people going through it. And, for people who haven't been there, again, the website is thrivemovement.com, and you have provided a plethora of tools on this website. Talk a little bit about some of the things that you're doing on the website, and obviously through the film as well, to empower people, to get them motivated, and to help them do some forward motion and not just be consumers of information.
Yeah, well, thanks for recognizing that about the tools, because that was our intention. We really created Thrive as a trailer for the website, because even if a person sees a movie 3, 4, 5 times, which a lot of people are doing with Thrive, ultimately it's a movie that you've seen, and then, you move on. And so we hoped that it would inspire people to go to the website, and we spent 3.5 years building, writing articles, loading up that website, and it's a place that you could literally go and spend months, if not a year, and still not go.
Oh, it's absolutely voluminous.
it's huge. It really is my life's work, and at least the parts that I felt were of value to other people. And it's continually growing all the time. So it really is an organic toolbox for people who want to actually be effective in transforming the world. So there's a research section. There's a solutions section. There's the solutions hub that I mentioned. There are places where you can go to find groups that are also working on solutions, and you can search them by zip code or by country or by sector. And by that, we mean what we've identified as the 12 major sectors of human endeavor.
Yes.
And that being economics, you know, media, science, justice, art, education, and so forth. But then you can also search by specific issue. So if you're someone who's trying to get fluoride out of your water or GMOs out of your food, or, you know, you've had your house taken by the banking scam and you just can't stand it anymore, you can go on there and search by those issues and find people in your area or anywhere in the world who are taking on those same issues. And then, you know, teach them what you know and learn from them what they know. Collaborate, you know, when useful. But we were committed to bringing the organizational and activist skills that each of Kimberly and I have worked on for our entire lives. We were committed to bringing that to bear and offering it to people, whoever was interested. Because Kimberly and I, even before we met, have fortunately been very successful in major activist movements in our lives. So we wanted to bring what we had learned, you know, the pluses and the minuses, to that website and to groups that are forming all over the world, not to create some giant organization over which we would centralize control. It's the last thing we'd want to do, even if we thought it would work, which it wouldn't. What we wanted to do was empower self-creating movements. And that's what's happening. I think that's one of the reasons why it's growing so much. Sometimes people will still write in and say, you know, I love your movie, I'm so inspired, now tell me what to do. And I'll write back and say, you know, thanks for taking it in. Now, you know, search your own soul for your path. What are you here for? And then get going on it. Use the website to collaborate with other people, and then write in and tell me what's working and what's not, and we can pass it on to others.
I thought it was interesting that you had the 12 sectors. That number, to me, is one of the divine numbers anyway. And within this grid, arts, economics, education, governance, relations, science, spirituality, I think almost everybody could find themselves within that schema in a way that they could fit in.
Yeah. Well, that's the point right there, Randy. I'm glad you said that, because we've been going all over the world working with groups who want to really organize around solutions. We've been calling them Solutions Summit Workshops. And the first thing that we ask people to do is self-identify. You know, you want to change the world, start just like Michael Jackson said, start with a man in the mirror. Go inside yourself and really get clear on who you are. And what we mean by that is, first of all, write down your purpose in life, your best shot at what you're here for. Then choose which sector or sectors you're most compelled by. Then write down what's the level of engagement that interests you the most. Are you an immediate needs person? You know, caring for the sick, feeding the hungry, you know, helping the poor, you know, in your day-to-day life? Or are you someone who feels more called to systemic change? You want to work with the banking system or communication systems or governance systems, so that the systems will ultimately be more effective in meeting people's immediate needs? Or, and this is the third and last one, or are you someone who is most drawn to working on the consciousness shift itself? Because all of our systems are an expression of our worldview, which is really an expression of our consciousness. So if you can clarify your own philosophy, your own understanding of how the world works, to the next level, you can design systems which are going to be more effective. It's anticipatory design, as Bucky Fuller called it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's a particularly highly leveraged act. When you can help other people with their own consciousness shift, we're going to have better systems and more people can thrive. So once someone has done that kind of exploration, then they kind of have a sense of who they are in the world, and that makes it a lot easier to know what you want to do. And once you realize that you can just go ahead and focus on your calling, what gives you the most energy. Then you don't have to go out and save the world by yourself, which is what burns out so many committed activists.
Yeah.
In fact, every single solutions group we've ever worked with in any city, when we ask people to self-identify this way, then we have them stand up by sector and level of engagement and so forth. And people start cracking up because they realize that every single other sector and every single level of engagement is exactly the commitment of choice of at least someone, if not a whole group of people, just in their own local community, much less in the world. So they actually get to see that they can do their calling in collaboration with a boundless number of people who are also doing their own calling.
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of overlap in all of these. We're all multimodality people, and we kind of tend towards one thing and then find out that we tap into something else that somebody else is working on. It gets very synergistic real fast. It's one of the things that I'm excited about with the global breakthrough energy movement and why I was very much drawn to begin working with this group. How did you get engaged with Global Breakthrough Energy Movement, and what is your vision of the work that they're doing right now, Foster?
Well, I was first contacted by them about a year ago when they were planning their first conference in the Netherlands, and unfortunately I was already committed to doing a tour in Australia at the time, so I couldn't attend. But I did a promotional video for them, and a lot of my friends in the field, you know, went to the conference and just reported that it was fantastic. And then Jeroen van Straten and several of the other leaders of the group came and met with me about 6 months ago here in California. Mm-hmm. And brought me up to date on what they were doing. And we did a lot of really, I think, powerful brainstorming, just kind of comparing notes on what it's going to take to get these energy technologies out, and who did we know anywhere in the world who was doing these things. Because just like with the 12 sectors, there are people who really want to work on the networking. That's what the Global BEM group is especially talented and skilled with. There are other people who are very skilled at vetting technologies to find out the ones that are real. There are other ones who really want to fund it, and other people who are very good at the business models. So it's critical to find people in all those different areas and then be collaborating worldwide, because that makes the whole movement not only well-informed and powerful, but decentralized. And that way it can't be taken down the way so many individual inventors have, who've just been, you know, working in their garage and word got out that they got something, and next thing they know, the FBI is knocking down their door and coming in with their guns drawn and, you know, giving them gag orders and stealing all of their equipment and so forth. And we just can't let that happen anymore.
These inventors deserve
the support from people with all the other skills and resources. So we need to be a lot smarter now about how to give the world access to technologies, which my sources tell me, you know, the shadow government has had for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
They've had these things in these black box projects where they've been working on it for their own agenda, but not sharing it with the world. And that's just, you know, unconscionable and destructive. So the time is coming, and it's not a matter of, oh, we've got to, you know, overpower the NSA or the FBI or something like that. No, it's a matter of simply getting the toothpaste out of the tube, getting the truth about how to align with nature in a healthy, supportive way out to the world, where nothing can be done to stop those truths and therefore to stop the creation of these and distribution of these devices anymore. And that's what's coming. You know, it's kind of like the whack-a-mole game, you know, at amusement parks.
Yeah.
If there's just a couple of moles and, you know, one big guy there whacking mole whenever it raises its head, then it's going to be bad news for the moles, and in this case, bad news for the world, because the devices aren't going to get out. But if there are hundreds of them in many, many countries all over the world, and they're all, you know, can kind of come out simultaneously and in a reputable way, then, like the electric car, its time will have come.
Yeah, you actually answered a question I had that I was going to ask you, and it was basically, the other side of my question is, how do we encourage those who are working to continue, given that the suppression, I mean, we've seen inventors ruined financially, they've had their lives destroyed, some of them have been killed, they've had their labs burned. Given that kind of opposition from a power structure that seems invincible, do you believe that by bringing this technology out into the open and I guess basically planning it into the systems, we are going to be able to encourage the kind of diverse development that's really going to be required?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And in terms of strategies, you know, some of the strategies I can't talk about publicly yet. Some I'll talk more in detail in my talk at the BEM conference in Boulder, because that's exactly what my talk is about. But things that I can say is that what I'm saying to these inventors is I encourage you to proceed, but only in a safe way. And that means that you and your lab and your information need to be secure. And then I'm saying to the network, this all needs to be decentralized. And then prior to your releasing the information about your device, you need to spend time building credibility with a network of people confidentially who will be believed. Because, you know, you can make anything appear to be real on video.
Sure.
But if you've got a team of very credible people who've all been educated and have had their people vet the technologies and so forth, who can come forward when the time comes and, you know, the global press releases are happening, and they can testify that, you know, I've checked this out, this is the real deal, then that's a whole different level of credibility that you build. And as well, people need to be savvy about how and when to use the media. I'm encouraging really creative humanitarian distribution plans, because if somebody just tries to bring this out and just, you know, hoard it all for themselves, or for one corporation or for the government or one individual or whatever, you know, the world will not respond well. The need is too great. There will be plenty of reward for anyone who does this successfully on every level. But I'm encouraging inventors to make sure that they've got a win-win business plan that really takes a lot of the profits and gets the technologies out to those most in need around the world who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford it for a long time. And doing things like that is not only, you know, ethical, it's also a way to let the world know that you're doing this for everyone rather than just for your own financial gain or to gain control over other people's lives and that type of thing. And that's where the whole paradigm changes. These devices demonstrate that we live in a world of infinite abundance. And once you know that, you can use these technologies to tap it, but then also to turn around and make sure that the people who are most disadvantaged have access to that infinite abundance just kind of completes the circle, or the torus, as you will.
Yeah, that's a beautiful metaphor. It brings me to another question that I had, and I've had discussions with Dr. David Martin, who will be in Boulder for the next Global BEM meeting as well, about this, and that is the use of the current system of patents that we have both in the United States and globally. And it's been the opinion of many people that have observed this, who have worked as I have in areas of technology, that it has basically hamstrung developers and investors. Do you kind of envision a more open source model of securing intellectual property, or do we need to find some new paradigms as well for preserving intellectual property and rewarding those who develop technologies?
Well, it's a great and core question at this time, and I'm glad you talked to David. I want to listen to that podcast, because I've never met anyone who knows more about the whole patent situation than David Martin. But from my perspective, well, as background for anybody listening to this who's not aware of it, the U.S. Patent Office has confiscated more than 5,000. I know David, the number David uses is over 10,000.
Yeah.
Alternative energy patents. And, you know, they do it on the basis of, well, you know, you're claiming a perpetual motion machine and that's impossible, or you're, you know, this would be in breach of national security, so we have to confiscate not only the plans, but your right to build your own creation. So I do not recommend to any inventor that they submit their plans for a new energy device to the U.S. Patent Office at this time, unless they figure out a way to do that where they're patenting certain aspects of what they've developed without making it clear that the parts go together to create a free energy device. I think there's some people who've done that very cleverly.
Sort of a segmented patenting process.
Exactly. Yeah, so that you're not giving away what you're doing, because the would-be controllers will clamp down on you. They have consistently when they see someone doing that. And the other thing that I'm seeing some people do is to go for patents in other countries first, so at least it's out there. Other people are going for public patents where they're not going to claim the patent to themselves, but it keeps some corporation from swooping in and taking over your patent and then just hoarding it for themselves. But what I'm seeing, and I've been having wonderful, exciting conversations with inventors, investors, business experts, and so forth about this whole spectrum of business models for breakthrough devices, and it goes from, on one end, pure open source in the sense that you're giving everything away. You've invented this thing and you just want to give it away to humanity, and so you publish it on the internet and you maybe give away a couple of devices so that people, you know, can see that it works and copy it and that kind of stuff. And that's fantastic. If somebody is willing and able to do that, that is the quickest and safest way to get free energy out to the world, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But it's very challenging, because most of these people have risked their lives. They've spent decades. They usually are hurting for money. Sometimes they've got, you know, many, many millions of dollars into the project with investors expecting some sort of reward. So it's a challenging situation for a lot of the labs. Another method that I recommend is that if there's sufficient philanthropic money and someone has got a working device that they're willing to give away, but they need some money, then we're suggesting, here, you know, what's your price? Is it five? Would you give it to the world for $5 million? You know, so you get your reward, and we, instead of, you know, the money people coming in and taking it and hoarding it or just doing it for themselves, they literally just, it's a gift of thank you to the inventor in return for that inventor being willing to give it to the world. So that's another one. Another possibility is the public patents that I mentioned. Another is that I'm encouraging a lot of the more substantial startup companies who've got some serious funding is to have a business plan where investors get paid back, but after a certain level of payback, their rate of payback starts decreasing. It doesn't ever have to disappear entirely, but it starts decreasing. And the delta, the gap between what they would have gotten and what they get now, all that extra money is committed to going into distributing the technologies to people who couldn't otherwise afford to have it, especially in countries where they're particularly in need of access to energy. And then I'll mention two more, and this really kind of rounds out the spectrum for me. One is what I just call conscious venture capital, where you know you've got a bunch of people who want to invest. They're probably expecting some return, but they're the type of investors whose top priority is transforming the world, not just getting the high rate of return for themselves. And so they can be worked with in a lot more flexible way, but still they'll get rewarded if the thing is successful, but they're not going to, you know, rape and pillage the inventors, as has unfortunately happened in so many occasions. And then the far end of the spectrum for me that is now emerging is what happened with what they call the Bloom Box, BLOOM. It's that former NASA inventor who's created a a high level of energy conversion technology that takes biogas and turns it into usable electricity off the grid. And there are companies like Google and eBay and so forth here in Silicon Valley that are powering entire office buildings and factories with these boxes. And I know that they had a venture capital of investment of a little under $1 billion from Kleiner Perkins, which is the kind of the premier investment.
One of the big hitters. That definitely,
And so that's absolutely unprecedented for them to go into alternative off the grid energy. So that's a huge step. I wouldn't recommend, it's not an actual, the Bloombox is not a free energy device. It's not over Unity, but it's off the grid. And the fact that the establishment is allowing and seeking and funding off the grid technologies is a huge paradigm breakthrough.
Well, and you bring an interesting point up, because I talk to a lot of people about this. The concept, the perception is that free energy encompasses this black box that we're all going to have, that we're going to put in our, I guess, the basement of our homes or whatever, and that will be the energy solution. But would you not agree that the real solutions are going to be integrated, they're going to be multifaceted and multidisciplinary? There's no one single solution for what we're looking at.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a really important point for people to understand right now, because just like with the solutions to any of these other problems, it's going to be messy, it's going to be multifaceted, it's going to take a lot of people. Having those technologies out there and having the conversion to using them be available to all sorts of different people is critical. So I've been in labs where they're working on a personal unit that will sit on in their basement, but very often the units that I'm seeing are tapping so much energy that the natural fit is literally selling them to the or leasing them to the energy companies and just putting them right into their facilities, and to replace this coal and oil and nuclear and all this kind of stuff, to replace it right away but use the existing grid. It's not the ultimate solution, because there's so much inefficiency in running this energy along these copper wires. But in the meantime, in the transition, there's a lot of solutions which are a very good fit for that. And I think that will also, keep the corporate people happier in the transition, because, they get a piece of the pie also. Yeah. I've talked to people from the public utilities, and they say one of the big binds on this is that most of them have 40-year debt obligations on their infrastructure expenditures. So they've got to pay back these loans that they took out based on future income. And if free energy just comes in and their infrastructure goes away, they're left holding the bag. I think there's going to be other ways ultimately of, right, of canceling that debt that we could go into at another time.
Well, that is another conversation, but basically they're looking at it from the viewpoint of the present economic system and all these long-term indebtedness things, bonds and whatnot that we've taken on. And as well as I do that ultimately this will be the game changer. The money system can't continue the way it is. It's far too toxic and destructive, and this is what they fear. But actually, in a lot of cases, for people like you just mentioned, it's also part of the solution to problems that right now they can't resolve under the current paradigm.
Yeah.
I guess in closing up today, Foster, the final round goes to you, but I want to ask you one thing. The spiritual values we need to embrace as we go through this change, what have you learned, and what is it that you want to put out as kind of a succinct nugget for people to follow in terms of the spirituality that has to go along with this?
Well, it's maybe the most important question of all. Some people have said, well, maybe we're just not spiritually ready for free energy. And that I don't agree with, because we've already got nuclear energy, and I've not seen anything in all of my explorations that's nearly as dangerous as nuclear. There may be scalar weapons that have been developed by the shadow government or something like that that could be super dangerous. Those are not any of the things that I'm looking at in these labs. But I think that what is possible is for us to recognize the humility that I mentioned before of harmonizing with nature rather than going up against it and trying to dominate it. That's a huge spiritual breakthrough for anyone, because that same mode of approaching the life force itself is true in communication. It's true in relating to your emotions. It's true in relating to your mind. It's true in, I know that you do the off-planet radio program. It's true in relating to interdimensional beings and
Absolutely.
Extraterrestrial
yeah.
beings. This whole thing of non-violation, you don't violate the forms of energy, you don't violate other people, you don't even violate your own emotional experience and so forth. So it's the key to accessing this energy. It's also the key to distributing this energy, is not allowing violation. So people don't get to suppress the energy, people don't get to use the energy in a weaponized way, people don't get to dominate other people by hoarding the energy. So it's a tremendous opportunity that these devices are signaling for us to, first of all, simply recognize that we are toroidal beings ourselves, in the notion that not only is the field around our body an electromagnetic torus, but that we are both distinct as our individual selves and completely unified with the rest of the universe. And the same thing with these devices. So recognizing the true nature of our spiritual being allows us to access this energy. It allows us to create these devices and then to distribute them and use them in a, in a healthy way that will actually support thriving rather than risking life on the planet.
I think that's a good place to leave it for this time. Obviously, the conversation goes in a lot of directions, and we had a limited amount of time today. Foster, anything else you want to say going out of this interview?
Well, I really want to encourage anyone who can to join us in October 10th to 12th at the University of Colorado at Boulder. There's just going to be a phenomenal group of experts in all different parts of this energy area coming from all over the world, and it's going to be a seminal conference. If you could have been there, at the beginning of the personal computer era, or when mm-hmm. they were first, when the Wright brothers were first flying a plane, or Henry Ford was rolling the first car off the assembly line, it would have been an unforgettable experience. And I feel exactly the same way about this. It's kind of like we were talking about with the Sequoia group. The right people are being invited to join together and take whatever the next necessary step is to make not only these devices, but this paradigm of harmonic resonance and infinite interconnectedness, boundless energy available to everyone all over the world.
And you can find the information for all of that by going to globalbem.com. That's global, the letters BEM.com. And all the information's there on how you can tap into this movement, how you can tap into information about the conference. This podcast can be found at globalbemvoices.com/transmissions. And our guest today, Foster Gamble, can be found at thrivemovement.com. I'm Randy Moggins for Transmissions, the global breakthrough energy movement. The truth is out there. It's inside you. We'll see you again next time.